We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Feel like Kobe in the fourth quarter. This is the Dane Moore NBA podcast brought to you by Blue Wire Podcast. Come at you Thursday afternoon. It's 1:30 p.m. As we sit down to record this, as Britt, you just told me you woke up, what would that be, 10 hours ago to start writing a column off of last night's loss by the Wolves to the Atlanta Hawks in Atlanta. It was a very interesting night. And before we even started talking about this, before I hit record, you referred to the game as effed up. So I decided to just hit record and let's get it going. Fire away. Why was last night effed up?
Because it was inconsistently called. It was a pretty clear cut way that Cat has been at once his own worst enemy and now being treated based on that history rather than on more recent history. And I just think we've reached the saturation point on Cat derision, I think. And I think it now is time to turn the page and take a look at what Cat has been doing fairly selflessly. I mean, you wouldn't know it to talk to him, but on the down low, the guy is doing things that are grunt work, are the things that role players often do. He is unquestionably the best player on this team, and I would argue the most valuable player on this team, given how little bulk and brawn is behind him. I don't think we have at a stage both league-wide among referees, among fellow NBA personnel, and among the Wolves fan base, I just don't think there is enough appreciation for what's going on with this team relative to Cat right now.
So let me ask you this. How much do you think specifically that play at the end of the third quarter with the technical and subsequent flagrant foul had to do with Cat's reputation in the referee's eyes?
I think it had to do with a direct answer to your question, some, not totally. I think the fact that they didn't see it when it was happening in real time made it pretty, you know, suspicious that when they went back and look at it, they go, oh, well, this is a flagrant foul, you know?
You know what's interesting is, like, do you think, so what triggered the even ability to be able to review the play is the fact that it came as the
final
buzzer
second
expired, right?
Right.
So the refs can look and will always look as a pretty much just if the shot's a buzzer beater to make sure it got out of their hands. So they're at the monitor there. I think what's an interesting thing to think about if that, you know, if that comes a second earlier and the refs don't decide that they want to review it themselves as a hostile act, if Nate McMillan would have challenged the play, right?
Uh-huh.
And and which it literally happened directly in front of Nate McMillan. It was right in front of the Hawks bench,
I believe.
You know, so that's a kind of, I think the answer to that is no.
I do too.
I don't think Nate McMillan would have, because I don't think it was an obvious.
We see it all the time. Somebody gets kicked on a shot, but not enough to create the kind of contact. Flagrant fouls were originally meant to prevent injury with people. You know, this isn't Draymond Green winding up and smacking somebody in the, you know, in the nuts with his full kick. This is a guy who went out and has been loose with his feet on his shots all season. He's gotten whistled for it a bunch of times. I'm not forgiving that aspect of it. I'm saying, does this particular play rise to the level of a flagrant foul? I think at absolute best, bending over backwards, it's a borderline call. And you've already assessed the guy a taunting tick. And now you're wiping out the basket. You're giving them two shots and the ball in the final seconds. It wound up being a 6-point swing. It could have been a 9-point swing if they'd hit a three on the possession.
5-8, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's one of those things that, and right on the heels of Ant being tossed, which I thought, again, just that second tech was like, you know, it was literally within one full second of the first tech.
Let me pause you real quick. The thing that stood out to me that you just said there is the kick out, the leg kick out thing happens all the time. And I agree with that. Cat does it all the time. It happens around the league all the time. It's a good point that you say the original reason for having flagrant fouls was to prevent injury. That was not an injury prevention situation. So all that is true. The one part I disagreed with in your column today was that what led to this was the Onyeka Okongwu getting into it with Cat sort of thing. And you said it was an obvious taunting foul on Okongwu 2 minutes prior to that. And I think, in my opinion, that's also something we see all the time where a guy blocks someone's shot and says, give me that shit. And it isn't called a taunting foul. Sometimes it is.
Right. Oh, I would agree with that. That if
you said obvious, though. That's what I disagree
with. By the standards of what was being called, you know, 2 minutes later.
Yeah.
I mean.
But it's 2 minutes later, right? Wouldn't it be different if the timelines there were reversed? I don't think it was an obvious technical foul on Okongwu. I think it certainly fueled Cat into all of it.
He was
pissed that the refs didn't call it, but yeah.
Here's what I think. I think that if Cat hadn't gone to the ref and said, why didn't you see that foul? I got fouled when I got hit. He would have had a much better chance of getting the taunting foul on Okongwu, who was saying that shit
even before. Yeah.
So what you're saying is that by objective standards, it's a taunting foul. I mean, you know, any way you want to look at it, Cat's behavior should have nothing to do with the situation, but somehow it does. But meanwhile, Okongwu's behavior didn't have anything to do with the call at the other end where he gets the N1 on similar contact.
That one was bad too, or it was very similar to, yeah, very similar contact, wasn't called one way, was called the other
right
way.
After the guy berated him. I mean, you know, if you want to play,
see, I just think
if you want to play the reputation game, you've got a second year backup center in the NBA berating, you know, a two-time all-star, best player on the other guy's team, so on and so forth. You've already thrown one guy out of the game on specious reasons. I mean, it just the whole thing.
That's fair.
The whole thing was messed up. The collective stink got too suffocating for my taste. I mean, I just think it was. Right. And look, Bill Kennedy is a
mismanagement. Mismanagement is the biggest reffing issue. I don't really have, like, guys miss calls so much.
Right.
So many refereeing calls are subjective, and that is what it is. The only time I really have problems with refs is in mismanagement of the game, the momentum, the flow of all of it. and Bill Kennedy and his crew.
And consistency.
Yeah, right.
Kennedy, actually, I think Bill Kennedy is a great ref. I should say that right up front. And I also think that Bill Kennedy's taunting call on Cat was a proper call. The guy was down on the ground. Cat stood over him for a second and barked at him and then spun around like a, you know, victorious warrior. That deserved a taunting technical.
I think Cat would even agree with that. Yeah. I think Cat knew he was getting a tech for that, right. And he wanted to because he was like, this young punk was just saying stuff to me.
Right.
So I think that's totally that. And
that's what Bill Kennedy called. But now, next thing you know, we've got this review.
Right.
And some yo-yo and Sea Caucus or one of his crew says, hey, you know, by the way, Okongwu went down forwards. You know, usually if you get kicked in the thigh, if it's hard enough, you don't go down forwards. He crumpled like he had been injured, got up, played fine.
He crumpled like he got kicked in the balls. That's how you crumple.
Which didn't happen, obviously.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, man, it was all a mess, and it's unfortunate in the context of what has been as Cat the Scorpio himself described as a fiery season for him. And it just, I don't know. I personally, I'm just kind of sick of all of this. I don't like having to sit down last night and make, you know, 50, 60% of what I'm going to talk about be about reffing and antics and clarifications on all that. And I'm sure you don't like having to write your column about that too. I mean, you started it with, apparently it's time to talk about Cat again.
Yeah. And
is not what I want to talk about again right now, I guess, but it is. But it's a story.
At the same time, I think it was appropriate because I think, as I said in the beginning, I think Cat is easy game now for people. I think that people think, hey, you know, the guy may be the best player on the team, and he may be a two-time All-Star, and he may be playing in a very selfless season on the court. His behavior at both ends of the court, his fulfillment of what they've asked him to do in terms of his role, all that stuff. You know. Meanwhile, Ant is charmed because Ant is charming. So because Ant is charming, you know, his lapses go by the boards.
Right. That was an interesting.
I mean, and not only that, but it's all of a sudden it's Ant being led astray by Cat's example.
Do you think that Cat's persistent rah-rah to the refs has had any influence on the frequency with which Ant complains to the refs?
No.
I don't know what I think about that, actually.
Do you think that Ant really follows the lead of anybody on the court besides himself, with a possible exception of somebody like Dame Lillard in terms of the way he shoots?
Not intentionally, or right? Like, you know what I mean? Where he is very independent in everything he does. But at the same time, like, what has Ant played, like 115 games in his career now, something like that? The vast majority of those games, and really like 75% of his minutes, he shares the floor with Cat. He's out there with Cat, who does that. So I don't know. I think he's an independent thinker and all those things, but he's also seeing that all the time. And I don't know. I think it would be a little counterintuitive to say it has no impact. Now, what you pointed out in the column, which was a really good follow-up to that, was what about Patrick Beverley? He's hot all the time too, and he's
far more respected in that locker room. Well.
And the difference I see between Ant and Pat Beverley, because Ant does talk to the refs a lot, as does Patrick Beverley. What I find frustrating about Ant's talking to the refs,
you mean Cat?
Ant.
Okay. About
Ant talking to the ref, not just last night, but in general. Is it often takes him out of the play, right? He's going for the basket, doesn't get the foul call, talks to the ref. Now it's 5-on-4 the other way. Patrick Beverley talks to the refs a ton, but I don't think he does it in situations that he picks and chooses his spots, right? A dead ball, those sort of things. I think he understands that he could take himself out of the play when he does that.
But he also,
and maybe that's just a problem.
He takes himself mentally out of the game.
I knew you'd follow up recently, with that, which is true.
More recently, I mean, since he's had a assortment of injuries, and since the team is further into the season and is, you know, the stakes seem to be higher, all of those things I think are contributing to Ant being more and more vociferous with the refs and his teammates and the coaches on the bench, you name it. You know, he, I remember him unilaterally deciding to foul somebody, I think it was in the Clippers game or something, to set up a hack of somebody, and the guy hit two free throws. And you, it was clearly Pat Bev's own, you know, invention on that.
Yeah.
And he has earned the right to have his own invention. But my point is, people like to deride Cat as being a terrible locker room leader and then say, oh, look at how he's influenced these people. Well, you can't have it both ways. You know, if he's a terrible locker room leader, then people just shine him on anyway. They say,
we also don't know, right? Like, there's so much, you know, guessing in that of how, who and what he is as a locker room leader, you know.
I think it is fairly easy to guess. If we know, I mean, you and I both been in enough locker rooms, maybe not at the professional level, but we know what type of attitude flies with athletes and what type of attitude is looked askance. And I think that Cat doesn't have, he is not a natural leader of fellow athletes. I think
Right. I agree with that, but I think it's different to say he's not a natural leader and to make that synonymous with he's taking away from others, right? I don't think Cat is a natural leader of men, but I don't think he's a bad locker room influence.
I agree with that.
On young players.
I agree with that.
That's
but what that means is, the point I was making and the reason this argument is consistent on my end was because you're saying, not you, but people who are saying that Cat is unfairly influencing Ant or influencing his teammates. D'Lo pretty much said, I don't go for all that rah-rah stuff. And he's saying it has an effect on the team. Well, you know, guess what? D'Lo not closing out on corner threes has an effect on team too. You know, I mean, it's just, there really is this thing of D'Lo is great on defense as long as Pat Bev does the dirty work.
Right.
Who does the dirty work for Cat? We got a double standard there. You know, I mean, and again, Cat is his own worst enemy here. You and I have torn our hair out or rolled our eyes at a lot of the things he says when he is trying to make points. He has a penchant for being grandiloquent, for being somebody who is grandiose, and to put himself in the center of melodramas. I remember he got rear-ended in a minor collision and said he had a 90% chance of dying or something. I mean, that's, you know, you can roll out whatever greatest hits of Cat you want, you know, that I take all the blame and give my teammates all the credit. I mean, there's a million of them. I go for 20-80 balls. You know, I mean,
pioneers of excellence.
There you go. So
we can make a list. We do that over.
Exactly. And so, but my point is, yes, those things can be mockworthy, but when Cat is upset at referees and opponents who do him wrong, he's sticking up for himself as a star in the NBA. I don't understand. Nikola Jokic, did you see clips of that thing last night?
Yeah.
And so, you know, meanwhile, you know, the Wolves fan base, part of it anyway, is carping on Cat. Jokic, you know, just goes berserk. And it's certainly not the first time this season that that's happened. And he did it in the playoffs.
Certainly not. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, Joel Embiid, you know, Joel Embiid is a tremendous defender and a great player. He's in the MVP conversation as Jokic was an MVP last season. How many times have we seen Joel Embiid piss and moan about incidental contact and collapse his 270-pound body onto the court and spread his arms out, you know?
It is, Britt. It's double standards on double standards. We are listing a bunch of them. What I wonder about, though, is, like, why, right? Like, these things don't just happen. It's not just bad luck. It's not the league being out to drive the Timberwolves.
I agree.
And the bottom of the league. So there's reasons. And there's nuance. There's context in all of this. And I don't know. It's complicated. And part of it, I know you agree with this, but part of it is on Cat, on historical precedent.
Yes.
Probably that's the biggest factor. And sometimes, like, until that changes, it's going to come back to bite him, I think, in untimely situations, like it right. did last night.
And I wrote an entire column about that in late October. I mean,
yeah.
When he went with the whole Valanciunas and the refs thing, mm-hmm. I think it was the third game of the season. And,
yep.
You know, I called him out in pretty stark terms. I remember his second year in the league calling him out for saying all is the game, blame everything on me, and Gorgui Dieng, you know, looking away in disgust. And then when I went to Gorgui, him saying as diplomatically as he could, you know, you need to be more specific about what you're taking the blame for. Right. I mean,
it grates, man. It grates.
It grates. But what we are at the point where it has begun to obscure what Cat is doing for the Timberwolves. Who is what? You're going to run Naz Reid, bring back Greg Monroe, get Nate Knight out there? I mean, you know, where's this team going without Cat?
Totally. No, that's absolutely accurate. Let's take a break here and then talk about where this team has been going prior to that weird chaos last night. Back with Britt in a second. Today's episode is brought to you by 20 by 20 Solutions, a Minneapolis-based technology consulting company that works with your business to help you build and sustain success. A great front office puts together a winning team with a coach who can put together a winning strategy. When leadership does its job and it all comes together, that means success. Success in business isn't any different. Business leaders need to find the right mix of technology, strategy, and talent to make things really work. And that's never been truer for growing companies. 20 by 20's team has helped grow companies from thousands of customers to tens of millions by helping businesses across a wide range of industries, from consumer technology and healthcare to manufacturing and even human spaceflight. Reach out to Clark and Ben, who are Wolves fans and fans of this show, by emailing them at team@20by20solutions.com. That's TEAM at 20x20solutions.com. And their team will review your needs and help you put together a plan before you need to make any commitments. 20 by 20 Solutions, technology, workflow, architecture, strategy. They're your sixth man on a winning team. All right, we're back with Britt Robson, Min Post. His column was predominantly on that Atlanta Hawks game from last night, Cat and everything that transpired in that game. Britt, I do think, though, which you didn't talk about as much, you did hit on the Warriors and what was the other game? The Knicks game.
Right. The previous two, right.
Yeah. Overall, since these guys have been back from COVID, the Wolves have, quote unquote, been back at full strength. That's eight games. And I believe they're 5-3 over that stretch. So even amidst some of this chaos and tensions right. running higher and the every game kind of seeming to be more, you know, I don't know, dramatic uh-huh. than it has been, the Wolves are on a better run of games, not necessarily against great opponents, but that at least provides some inspiration, I think, as they come up on a very difficult stretch of six games here against very good teams, specifically really good offenses. So how do you feel that these past couple weeks of games have set them up for these next few weeks of games?
I am concerned over the third quarter performance in the last two. that strikes me as a very immature team. I actually thought they were moving beyond that. It was very disappointing to see the Knicks and then the Hawks, two teams, by the way, that I think if they played each other 10 times, the Wolves at this stage should win a majority. They certainly should win a majority against the Knicks and at least go 5-5 against the Hawks.
I'd agree with that.
So those are winnable games. Granted, they were on the road, and in that eight-game stretch, I think they had three at home and five on the road. So they are playing a very road-heavy schedule. And even the home games really aren't a home stand. They're single games, so you don't really sleep in your own bed for very long, if at all. So I would say that what has been positive is that D'Lo's shot is going in. Noel has found himself. And Torian Prince has actually been really good in minor infusions of minutes. What is not going good is Pat Beverly and Jade McDaniels continue to shoot like they're shooting well, and they're not. And I think that makes a difference. They're both cranking out about, you know, three or four trays a game minimum and making, you know, less than 30% of them. I do think shot selection is important. I think moving the ball and getting it to people. Okogie was, you know, I'm a huge Okogie stan. What he did last night, I mean, just because you can get to the rim doesn't mean you can finish, Josh. I mean, the guy, you know. So I think they need to play smarter. I think they need to get the ball into the hands of people that know what to do with it. I think that on defense, they remain a team without much margin for error. I am really impressed with how they've held that taut line between too antic and not antic enough. They've held that turnover margin line really good. Now they haven't converted as much as they were earlier in the season because I don't think the steals are quite as good. I think Vando has hit a little bit of a wall recently. Teams have begun to scout him off the offensive glass a little bit more. And I think he's become a little bit, and rightfully so, infatuated with getting points for a change. And that may have diverted him a little bit from his overall energy, you know, Energizer Bunny role. But in general, I don't expect them to beat Brooklyn. Who are the others? Big games. I know their Golden State is in there.
Yeah,
I think they will beat Portland.
Brooklyn, Portland, Golden State, Phoenix, Utah, Denver.
Yeah, there you go. I would say that just, you know how things change. Everybody would have penciled in Golden State as a loss, and then they had both Draymond and Curry out. So all things being equal, everybody being at full strength, only the Denver game, and that's only because, you know, Murray, they're not at full strength. We know they won't be. Right. But I would say that certainly Phoenix, Utah gives them trouble. It's going to be difficult. But that doesn't
– all six of those teams have above average offensive ratings.
Yes, yes.
With actually Golden State having the worst amongst them. And I think I get a little reactive to when the Wolves defense just gets totally picked apart, as it did last night by the Hawks and Trae Young. I kind of assume then that that's going to lay a little bit of a blueprint for the next opponent. I think specifically the way Trae operated is, you know, and the way they did it, with the way he just kind of drags that high wall over to the sideline and then is able to find the roller there for a lob or just kind of sitting underneath the basket. I think that other teams could duplicate that, but I've said that about other times this season as well, where the Clippers, remember earlier in the year?
Yeah.
When they were just splitting that.
Right.
And Washington was a different way there too. But to the Wolves' credit, it abides, right? Like the defense, it does bounce
because
back.
Because they hustle. I mean, yeah. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they do put pressure on the ball. And that's a Finch first principle on defense, and it is effective. I was surprised at how often they willingly switched the pick and roll so that Cat was out just inside the three-point arc, face up on Trae Young. I mean, that's not a great outcome.
I think it was just and Finch kind of said in postgame, he's like, well, we just kind of started throwing everything. Because Trae can wreck that high wall.
Right.
I mean.
He can, but he can also, I mean, he obviously was hot. And so
you put,
because Beverly is out, you put either Okogie or McDaniels on him and just hope for the best. But when you don't put Cat on him or almost anybody else, I mean, he made like 4 35 footers, I think, in that third quarter.
He wasn't just picking it apart. Then he was just like, you know, going right through
shot. He found a rhythm. Yeah. And then that one play where Cat literally looked like a matador or maybe a statue. That one play where Euro stepped past Cat. Cat looked like he was like trying to not be seen, you know? I mean, it was such a horrible, this team continues to be a team that, as I just mentioned, doesn't have a lot of margin for error, but depending on the way other teams' opponents attack it, it's almost like, when you have these stratomatic games or these football games where you lay a defense card down and an offensive card down and pull them apart and who guessed right in terms of the play, it's like whatever the Wolves are trying to take away strategically that night versus whatever the offense is trying to get, if it matches up, then the Wolves can be pretty effective. Because as Finch said the other night in answer to a Atlanta beat writer, I assumed it was, all these national media, because they won in Madison Square Garden, suddenly are looking at the stat sheet and saying, oh, the Wolves are a top 10 defense. How did that happen?
Right.
So now we're getting those questions, you know? And so Finch laid it out and he said, we play harder, more aggressively on the ball than most teams do in drop or other types of coverage. And that can discombobulate opponents who aren't used to it. And I think that's true. I think that's one factor. I think another factor is that it's a make or miss league and Finch prefers to guard the paint more than the arc. And so if a team is hot from the arc, there's a very good chance the Wolves are going to get torched.
Right. I've thought about it in a lot. I've started switching some of my thinking to all of this stuff in the context of a playoff series, right?
Oh, yeah, that'll be tough. That's a whole other level.
Yeah, right.
They're not ready for a playoff series against a good team because they will get picked apart.
Right. There are things to pick apart. There is that margin of error to try to exploit.
And
you're right. It
will,
is getting ahead of yourself.
Will definitely do it.
Right. Yeah. To the defense point, or the opting to have teams beat you from three versus from two. I know we've talked about this some, where the Wolves have gotten good, quote unquote, good shooting luck. I do think something that plays into that is the fact that, as you said, they hustle, they close out well. That's a factor. But as much as we've talked about this starting five and their incredible net rating this season, I didn't realize that when it was that plus 50 net rating before all the guys went down with COVID, that opponents were only shooting 16% from three against the Wolves starting five. And, you know, I mean, even if we want to say like, oh, their hustle knocks off 8%, right? Like that's you're still getting another 12% of shooting luck. And I don't even necessarily mean that as an indictment. And quite frankly, we've talked about it. Like, we knew that starting five in and of itself was not going to be enough. We talked about they don't they don't play together enough. There was obviously going to be regression. So it sounds like I'm framing this as a negative thing. But what I think is encouraging is since these guys have came back and they've been at full strength, and the Wolves have actually been getting beat with the starting five on the floor, that net rating has drastically dropped. The Wolves have still been winning games.
Right.
And that's a credit to Finch finding those blended lineups more so. I said it before the season started with you. I thought one of the biggest things that Finch had to solve was rotations with this team. It was just a roster that made that really difficult. And I think that has become increasingly on point with Finch as the season has gone on. And I think Jalen Noel has helped unlock a lot of that in finding different lineup combinations. And that has to sustain because the dominance of the starting five will not sustain. And it also just probably won't play together that much because Patrick Beverley gets hurt a lot, you know, like knock on wood. Right. I think it's a matter of time till Jared Vanderbilt like bruises his tailbone and has to miss a week or, you know, even just the natural wear. Ants never missed a game for an injury. D'Lo, Cat have been healthy for the most part. So I find that encouraging that Jalen Noel has unlocked a lot in these blended lineups, and some of those other guys like Torian Prince and others haven't been as big of sort of sore thumbs when they enter the game.
Right. I think what is interesting about Prince is even if he...
I like him, man. I've liked him all year.
Even if he doesn't play very well, the role he plays on the team, he just needs to be not terrible. I mean, you know, I mean, you need a little size at that position and you're surrounded by shooters. And he's comfortable with that game. He's comfortable being like a fourth option from three-point territory. And he has learned that flying around will keep him on the court more than, you know, measured defense will. Yeah. And consequently, I think he kind of flames out after about 6 minutes. But that's all Finch really wants anyway, you know?
Yeah, right.
And so I think it certainly isn't the size of the role nor the prominence of the role that he envisioned for himself. But I looked at net rating the other day, just casually, last 9 games, last 15 games, whatever, you know, just going through different gradations. Torian Prince has been very valuable, and it's not just garbage time. It's he comes
well,
in.
Well, Finch has used him to kind of like
bridge,
clog a leak. Yeah.
Right.
You know,
right.
And it's in these times. I mean, if memory serves, a lot of the time he checks in for the first time
third quarter,
right? Or even earliest, like kind of mid second quarter.
Right. Right.
And oftentimes that's triggered by Jaden McDaniels getting his 3 first half fouls that he does nightly, or, you know, or some sort of foul trouble. They'll go to Prince when D'Lo got foul trouble. Yeah, he's the break glass in case of emergency game.
And also because he's a veteran who, position-wise, I think he works with D'Lo well. I have no idea what their two-player net rating would be, but I think that they're both veterans who understand what the other one is doing on the court. I think he is good beside Ant. For the opposite reason, I don't think he's on the court very often with Ant, but when he is, I think he covers some of Ant's, you know, lapses on defense. I think he tries to be helpful on the court because he knows that Finch is smart enough to see that, and he's pretty desperate for minutes, as who can blame him? I mean, he's finishing up a $13 million contract. I agree with you that Prince and Noel, what makes Noel valuable is suddenly Noel can be a playmaker for other people. That was not something, I mean, I'm sure that when Rosas drafted him, he might have said, and he can even do a little point guard, you know, but nobody took that seriously, you know. First of all, his handle, I think, has improved. His confidence has improved to make his handle even better. He's seeing the court better on purpose. And just, you know, apropos of nothing, I don't buy at all that he always believed in himself. This guy has had a confidence issue at various times in his stints here. I think he would like to say, you know, I've always been this confident. But what we've seen when he is this confident is a different player.
Right. I think what's really interesting about him, and it kind of again counters the narrative that he came into the league with of just being a shooter, which was always wrong, is the idea that he shoots over 60% of his shots from two. He is an attacker,
right?
And it's another strike against the, like, Beasley and him are the same position,
exactly.
Same role, sort of
very
guy.
Very different, and actually Beasley really shoots. Good together, at least at one end of the court. I mean, they really. That's a baton pass. You don't want the big three taking turns, but I don't mind Beasley and Noel taking turns at all.
Right. The numbers there? With those two. Yeah. Sorry. We got a little bit. I think we're back.
Okay.
With those two on the floor, the defense has actually been good over the stretch. So that might be a little bit of a small sample size.
Well, Kogi and Taurean Prince, actually, Finch gets, maybe. He says what they need is on-ball defense. That is the priority when those two guys share the court. Get somebody else in the game who can defend the ball. And Noel has actually defended the ball pretty well. Beasley has yet to defend the ball since he's come to Minnesota, as far as I can see.
That's true. Well, let's mix in one more break here and then and then kind of look forward at the rest of the year.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If you're a basketball junkie, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Twice a week, JJ Redick is cooking on his podcast, The Old Man and the Three. He has guys come on in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, including Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron in Miami, and the moment Tyrese Halliburton knew Pascal Siakam would be a good fit in Indy. In addition to player interviews, every Monday, JJ breaks down the top three things happening around the NBA with unmatched analysis, not outlandish takes, and is often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler to dive deep on rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? You won't find another outlet that covers the game as comprehensively and with such insight as JJ does it on The Old Man and the Three. Make this your companion podcast during the playoffs. Listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, back again with Britt Robson of Min Post for a final segment here. Britt, we've been talking a lot about what's immediately been happening, what's kind of been happening around them. We're starting to get an idea of really what the identity of this team is as some players come into focus, some players present themselves, some players kind of prove to be bits of a letdown. And with that comes, you know, what's not only the rotation going to be for the rest of the season, but what's the roster going to be for the rest of the season? And I'm curious, as the trade deadline comes, what you would think in Finch's eyes is the most expendable player in the Wolves rotation to potentially be replaced via trade?
Okogie.
But he's not in the rotation.
Oh, I see. I see. Yeah, well, I mean, he's probably 10th. Are you talking top eight?
Yeah, sure. 8, 9.
I think that what the most intriguing, I would have to frame it that way, is Beasley, simply because he has a skill that is coveted and he's making a big number, which means he could fetch something significant in return. If a team is interested enough to trade for Beasley, they know his value and want his specific skill. I think
maybe a big if.
Well, I mean, the guy, for all the ripping on Beasley, have you checked his, you know, his latest three-point shooting? I mean, the guy still fills it up.
Right.
And there are teams still. I mean, three-point shooting has never been worse. Well, hasn't been worse for like 5 years. There's a lot of clanking.
I think if he was like a $6 million player rather than a $16 million player, I think tons of teams would be trying to go. I mean, look at what Bryn Forbes just, you know, was a
$9 million
that
right.
teams are trading. I think he was $4.5 million.
Oh, was he? Okay.
But I think that's
a poor man's Beasley, Bryn Forbes.
Right, right. No, and Beasley's above that. It's just that Beasley is more expensive,
right.
which I think kind of complicates it. I also think that,
but it might simplify it.
Maybe
if a team has a $16 million guy that they don't like. I mean, I don't know what, for example, Satoransky makes, just to pick one out of a hat.
I think like 11, yeah.
Okay.
So, but yeah, you could work that.
You know, something like where, you know, and to have a big combo guard, point guard, you know, somebody who, you know, can fill that backcourt role on offense. And the Wolves, you know, even though Noel has kind of come through, if you're going to play Pat Bev and D'Lo together as much as Finch wants to, I think, you know, having Satoransky or somebody like that is an option. I also obviously think that a different kind of better Taurean Prince in the 3-4 role, combo forward role, would be important. Or you take somebody's awful $16 million player and get a pick, you know, and maybe it's a pick like 27th. But, you know.
See, I think that's what Finch wouldn't be into. I think he sees value in Beasley and in that he is a shooter.
Yes.
And that this team, a team competing for the playoffs, does want that shooter option out there. And then that isn't something that he would want to have replaced for a different skill set.
You know, that's now that you say that, I think that I'm leaning into my own bias a little too much, buying the idea that Noel can not replace Beasley, but is a sufficient, you know, placeholder in those Beasley minutes. But one of the catechisms I go by that I just ignored, if you want to know how much a coach likes or dislikes somebody, look at minutes played. And Beasley is in the top three. Now, some of that is he never got sick. But still, I mean, Malik Beasley is behind Ant and Cat in terms of minutes played on this team. So Finch obviously likes him on the court.
Well, okay. So along those lines, this is my answer to that question. I think it lines up. I think the player that Finch would most like to replace is Naz Reid on the team and those backup center minutes. I think Finch, like most people, see, you know, some ball skills in Naz and that he can, you know, space the floor a little bit. But I say Naz because what this team desperately needs more is rebounding, and it needs size on the interior that they really miss in the minutes that Cat rests for this team. And I think we've seen Finch get more aggressive with Cat's total minutes. What was that, 3-4 games ago where Cat played the entire second half because they felt they couldn't survive without the physicality
right.
out there. So that would be my guess for what Finch would want to replace most within the Wolves rotation, and just kind of have that being an athletic but more traditional backup five who is physical enough to really just help the rebounding and maybe give up a little bit offensively, but give you a lot more defensively.
So do you think that the fact that Nate Knight fouls too much, you think that's why he doesn't get elevated over Nas? Because Nate Knight does do some of that.
I think it's because he's 6'8". I think it's because he's 6'8".
But he plays 6'10". He plays,
I think,
he plays hard. I mean, he's put it this way. I think he's an easy slot in for Vando. When Vando goes out, if you wanted to put Knight in on that
role. Yeah, I think he's a four.
On that role. Yeah, but Nas is kind of a four too, you know?
Nate Knight is a two-way player who shined a little bit in the COVID time, like freaking Lance Stephenson, right. You know?
But Nas could be that too. I mean, Nas,
no, I this isn't me complimenting Nas.
My point is that if in fact Finch wants to see what a non-Nas rotation is like, why did he dump Greg Monroe? I know there's salary reasons in that, but why does he continue to not want to put Nate Knight in those circumstances? I think in terms of fiber in the paint, which is really what you're talking about, Nate Knight can't touch Nas's ceiling, but he very, very infrequently will go to Nas's floor. Nas is all over the place on defense. He's really good one night, really awful the next. I think he's a guesser. Yep. I think he guesses a lot on defending people. I think he also, if you talk about somebody who's been influenced by Cat in terms of bitching at the refs, I think he's Exhibit A. I mean, his sense of entitlement on official calls is ridiculous.
Right. I think Nate Knight is physical. I think in terms of rebounding, he provides a lot more as an offensive rebounder than a defensive rebounder. I think those are different skill sets. As a whole, this team, you know, trends that way, having offensive rebounding skill set rather than a defensive rebounding skill set. And what I'm talking about is a center who's the opposite of that, who is similarly physical to Nate Knight, but is literally bigger and also and also just a really sound defensive rebounder. I also think that's...
You're describing Greg Monroe.
No, Greg Monroe is a bad defender.
He's slow.
No, I'm talking levels above that.
Okay.
I'm talking levels... I mean, Greg Monroe...
You're talking about a trade piece for somebody. You're talking about getting Torian Prince's $13 million in exchange for a guy like that.
Yes. And I don't have a specific name. Maybe I should have dug into that.
No,
a little
fine.
Bit more. But you know what I mean? Like there's a ton of backup centers around the league who are 6'11", 7 foot, you know, that
what
can give you
Mo
15
Wagner?
Minutes. Also, no.
The elder Wagner boy.
On that team, maybe Robin Lopez. Maybe that's an example there.
Oh, yeah, I know, but I think he's falling off fast. Last couple of times I've seen Robin Lopez play.
Well, we don't have the specific name, but I don't think it'll be impossible to find that type of big if they need it. I think the conundrum more so is particularly dependent on how good of a big you acquire is what impact that would have not only on Naz Reid, as it would replace Naz completely in the rotation, but if it's an even higher caliber player than that, you know, how much does that player cut into Jared Vanderbilt's minutes at all? And that's why I think this imaginary big I'm envisioning is not that good. Probably isn't the Torian Prince $13 million type of guy.
Uh-huh.
Is more of like a $5 million guy, and you do something. Where maybe it's Jake Lehman going out. And then also, I think to kind of sweeten the pot a little bit, because another team might be interested, is then maybe you have to include Naz Reid in the trade.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense. Like Jake Lehman.
Because you don't
want
to take Naz out.
Right. For that combined would be about six, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think something like, yeah, yep. I think you're right there. So I don't know. I mean, you know how I feel about Naz. I think he... has a skill set that can make it in this league.
Yeah.
I don't think that skill set meets up with this Timberwolves roster's needs. And when you talk about marginal improvement for a team, I think it's tweaks like that that historically you see teams make at the trade deadline. I think with Chris Finch, I think he likes Nas, but I don't think that's some. I don't think he would be pounding on the table to say, no, I still want Nas to be our backup five.
And the reason I mentioned Okogie is because I think Okogie's value goes up during the postseason.
Mm, that's a good point.
I think that he's an expiring contract, so you're just taking a look-see. You know that he's going to
– You get his bird rights. He's a restricted free agent. Yeah, he's gonna, there's something nice
he's
about
He's going
that.
To bust his ass for whatever team – acquires him, and he's going to go out. And if you stick him on somebody for 6 minutes in the playoffs, you don't care if he scores. In fact, you tell him not to shoot. And you essentially try to lock up. Let's say it's Luka. Let's say you're playing Dallas. Yeah. Throw Kogi on Luka and piss off Luka for 5 minutes. You know, I mean,
right.
To get that for next to nothing, you know.
Right.
That type of, or, you know, I mean, he's also really good at doubling down on people. I mean, if you need to double team Jokic with a double down right. guy or something. But there's all kinds of ways Okogie can be valuable in a short series when all you're trying to do is take something away from somebody.
And he just doesn't fit on this team.
Unfortunately.
He's not playing.
Yeah, he's not playing. And I think that
his role is literally Jared Vanderbilt's in foul trouble, you play, or Patrick Beverley's in foul trouble, and you play.
No, I think That's there it. Are times when Noel and Beasley are on the court together and you need an on-ball guy and you don't have okay. to worry. He has got, I mean, believe me, I chart Okogie's minutes because I'm interested in finding out when the dude will play. But
It's funny we're both you're suggesting trading Josh Okogie and I'm here suggesting trading.
And you know why? Because we both think that the guy has hidden value. You know, I mean,
yeah,
you know,
I guess that's true.
I mean, you're thinking that, you know, let's say Chicago wants a backup of Vucevic that, you know, gives, with all those guys who fly around in that lineup, you know, put Nas on the court with that crazy rookie they have. And, you know,
IO. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of.
Yeah. No, I think that's what makes them. It's just going to be important for the Wolves if they make any trades. Well, I think it will just kind of be a requirement that the money they are sending out is not viewed as a gross negative. And right. the real options for that on the Wolves team are on the cheap Nas and Okogie. And then, depending on what a team thinks of Beasley and how much they value that skill set, maybe some will see Beasley as closer to a neutral value at his 15, 16. And then Torian Prince has some of that too, not because he's worth $13 million, but because he is
expiring.
So those are kind of like, it's probably the natural four to look at, but I would include all four of them as potentially traded away
right.
options.
And then we also have to take into consideration what I'm almost certain is a verbal or handshake deal in terms of what Beverly is going to get to stay here.
Right. I talked about that last night.
Oh, did you?
Just because it was like, okay, he rolled his ankle again. Right. That's now another, right. like,
$10 million obviously. Assistant coach. Right. 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 Right.
Yeah. And it's not that Patrick Beverley hasn't had a ton of value for this team. It's just, I think we've talked about it before. I think it's just an interesting proposition of what he signals in the idea of bringing him back. I mean, you're kind of in then on this iteration of the roster, like immediately. And I'm not saying that's a wrong way to look at it, right. but you can look at it different ways. And it just, it makes more sense. If Patrick Beverley would have played 74 games this year, it makes a lot more, you just feel better about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're trending towards him missing what?
His usual amount, like 25, 30 games, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's that he's missed 12. And three of those were COVID. One of them was a suspension. Let's see how long this
couple
ankle.
Of groins, an ankle, you know.
Right.
But
right.
I think
I can't even remember what all of them.
I think it's very revealing. that neither one of us even thought for a second to think of, say, Pat Beverly, when you said, who on this roster? Chris Finch will keep Beverly around. And Beverly knows it. Finch really appreciates it. Finch never misses an opportunity to, you know, cite him as the difference. And I remember the way...
You know what would be nice is if he was on Beasley's contract and Beasley was on Pat Bev's contract, right?
Yeah.
One more year of Beverly would be real nice at the same number, even if it's like, you know, that high 14. And if Beasley was expiring, like that would totally change things.
Chris Finch talks about Pat Beverly the way Flip Saunders used to talk about Kevin Garnett.
Wow.
He would say, KG is the guy. I mean, I don't have to worry what goes on in that locker room. KG has got the locker room sewed up. You know, Flip would say, you know, KG will set the tone on defense for us. KG will do this. Finch talks about Beverly the exact same way.
Yeah. No, and we certainly have the evidence on the floor. And I think just from the extra interactions that we get to see covering the team being there, I think the locker room part checks out too. The one just like gray hair in that is...
I love that gray hair.
Patrick Beverly is a lot older than the rest of the group.
And yes.
And I wonder how that in terms of locker room interactions works, because, and you can correct me on the KG part of this, but for the most part, like in that locker room were a lot of guys around his same age and his friends, right?
Yep.
And I don't know. I don't know what difference that is. That just came to my mind.
Well, I mean, I think in that instance, I would say more Sam Mitchell. In fact, in some ways, he lines up a lot better with Sam Mitchell.
Yeah, that is good.
In terms of his tenure, because Sam was a salty guy who loved to keep everybody on their toes. You know, different guys, different ways. Even like Berea, when he was here, would just, you know, would just enliven the locker room. Just the way they act, the way they... You know that Pat Bev is, you know, actually we don't know it because we're not in there. It's not the same as when you saw, nobody would have known, for example, the way Butler and Jamal Crawford bonded in the locker room, because they weren't that way at all outside the locker room. Inside the locker room, it wasn't Butler and Taj. It was Butler and Jamal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Constantly.
That was so insightful that season, which I don't. Being in the locker room that year, you saw the schism between the Jimmy Butler side of the locker room and the Karl Anthony Towns side of the locker room.
Right.
And Tyus Jones kind of towed the middle of both of them.
No, Tyus Jones was not in the middle of that.
He was the Butler side.
Oh, man.
Well, he wasn't the – I think both Jimmy and Kat liked Tyus.
Tyus was the
hometown
guy. But
other than that,
guy,
there were the bifurcation.
Yeah, Tyus was the hometown guy. I don't think Tyus had any patience for Kat, and I think Tyus really liked Butler, partly because Butler was the alpha and Butler liked Tyus, and partly because, let's face it,
we'll put him in the old heads group.
Tyus's game really lined up with what Butler liked, you know. So, but all that said, you know, and then you had Jeff Teague over on the side, who was like this weird outlier, brutally honest with the press, just dropping, you know, science in all kinds of crazy ways. And at the same time, being this WWE guy and this weird musical taste guy. He was another really rich addition to that locker room. It was a great locker room. I miss the locker rooms. That's what we're doing. We're reminiscing about when we got to know.
No, seriously. It's been so long that I don't even really like think about it.
And it probably isn't going to happen again. You know, a lot of people are saying.
I hope not.
A lot of people are saying.
I hope so. I hope it does come back.
A lot of people are saying now that players have had this freedom from the media, that'll be something they really want. And they'll probably try to use some justification of virus or, you know, something in the union contract. We'll give you this as long as we don't have to have these guys lurking around as we dress and undress and talk shit about
which people. I do understand from their perspective to some extent, but I also think the other side of the argument that they might not understand is that it really does help us provide a lot of insight, and ostensibly into different degrees, you know, we are the microphone to them and create intrigue in the product, just again, to some extent, that, you know, that drives interest in the league, drives interest in the product, which makes it more expensive, which, you know, I'm not taking credit for $50 million contracts.
Right.
But I think some of that that stuff does matter. I wonder if any player, I don't know, they might just shake that off. But
I have my social media. I've got 6 people on my social media staff, and I've got my own private social media account. Whenever I really want to go direct with people, screw the media. Mm-hmm.
Right. No, and I think that's fair, but it's also just accurate that when the information is being filtered through a theoretically
I get it.
Neutral source.
I get it.
It you know, it might, you know, mean
believe me,
more.
I am the dinosaur that will be carted out to the trash when all this happens. You know, I mean, it's not like I'm going to break the social media grip that they have by by worming my way into the locker room and getting, you know, as long as Cat has a historical fact he needs double checked, maybe I'll get called.
He
on.
Loves you for that.
It's pretty comical.
I laugh. All right, last thing, Brooklyn on Sunday, because we got 3 days off here, so I'm thinking people will be listening to this.
No KD before that. And Kyrie, right?
No, Kyrie will be playing.
That's what I mean. No KD, but Kyrie, it isn't in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. is it?
No,
it's here. That's
it's
right. Yeah, so Kyrie will play and Harden will play. We may see some Okogie there, although that'll be...
Is Pat Bev going to play?
If Pat Bev doesn't play well, we'll certainly see Okogie. I think Pat Bev will play just because it's 4 days away or 3 days away now, I guess.
Right. I was watching them this morning, man. Kyrie doesn't look any worse.
I saw the Cleveland game and he was really...
Yeah, I watched that one too. Yeah. And LaMarcus Aldridge.
Exactly. That is the guy that, you know, he's getting the Blake Griffin minutes and he's changed the way they, you know, he's not he is a lunch pail guy, but he's a usage guy. He's not a glue guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, they rely on LA to, basically get buckets inside. And he's really working well with Kyrie, too.
Do you think they're going to win the championship?
No. Personal bias.
Who would you take?
I like Phoenix.
Gun to your head right now.
I mean, I
was thinking about it while I was watching today, and I think I'm at the point where I think I will take Brooklyn out of the East, and then I like part of me wants to say Utah against them.
A lot of it has to do with whether Donovan Mitchell can be a top 10 player. He's been we're a little biased. I'm a little biased anyway. I'll admit this. Donovan Mitchell destroys this team.
Weren't all 3 of the Wolves wins against them last year without Donovan Mitchell?
Probably. But what I do know is
at least 2.
I probably see usually I see a player twice as often not playing the Wolves as I do them playing the Wolves. But that still means a third of the minutes that I see of those guys is usually against the Wolves, especially if they're in conference. I'm probably biased, but I do think that Mitchell makes Utah really formidable. I think that Gobert's absence has pretty well cinched his value. I mean, they were awful on defense without him and right back to being pretty good. Although they lost to like Houston the other night, didn't they?
Yeah. Something like that. I don't remember, but they've hit their bump. So maybe that, I think I might've said Utah like a month ago.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
But I'm Phoenix also. And so I'd go Brooklyn.
Such a good team. They've got
it's
guys.
It's interesting that it's not obvious. This isn't right. Like,
well, you know, who's actually taken a step this year is Cam Johnson. I mean, he's that much derided draft pick that they got for the Dario Saric deal. Yeah. And
my God,
he's played really well. He's played really well. And so
I checked in on Culver's free throw percentage this year the other day.
40?
Still 50%.
Yeah.
No, he's at 50.
Well, you know, and Wancho just got traded again. I mean, that Pat Bev deal just continues to make me laugh. You know, although Memphis is getting the last laugh too. Boy, are they good.
Yeah.
But no, they're not ready in the playoffs, I don't think.
Yeah, I was listening to Zach Lowe, and he had Chris Harrington on who covered.
I love Chris Harrington.
Yeah, great. And man, was that like a love fest from two people I respect of or particularly Zach, in almost like putting Memphis in the contender.
I know. Well, Don Schulman, who is another guy I really respect a great deal, who does the most informative power rankings by a country mile of anybody. Mm-hmm. I would highly suggest anybody who wants to have a broad range of knowledge of the NBA without watching a lot of NBA. Let's say you don't have League Pass. If you read John Schulman's Monday power rankings every week, you will automatically have a pretty good handle on the NBA. He is that good, I think.
Yeah.
And he has Memphis first this week.
Really?
Yeah. I don't buy it myself. I mean, I see them as a good regular season team. I actually see them as like Utah 3 years ago, or, you know, maybe Phoenix last year until Phoenix was even better than that. But I think a team needs to have playoff experience in order to get deep into the playoffs. I think the dark horse.
I think that's the best matchup for the Wolves.
Yeah.
If they make the playoff. I mean, easily, in my view.
Right.
I'm not, if that's the 3-6,
I know.
If the Wolves get the 6, best case scenario is Memphis. And I mean, I think Memphis
is serious,
but I would go. I think the Wolves would win more than one. I do.
I would
say Memphis in 6 or 7. Uh-huh. And if it were Wolves Utah, I'd probably go Utah sweep. If it were Wolves Suns right now, I'd go Suns sweep. Warriors, maybe the Wolves get one. You know
who else I think is a real dark horse? And I'm surprised I'm saying this because I don't like Jason Kidd as a coach, but Dallas looks really good.
Lately, yeah.
Yeah, no, but I mean, they're really...
Marquise Chris.
I know.
He would have been interesting in that Nas thing we were talking about.
He would have been interesting last night, wouldn't he? He would have hit somebody, don't you think?
Yeah, probably.
What a hothead.
All right, Britt. This was fun. I'm glad we got through the Atlanta game stuff somewhat quickly.
Well, as you said, I was in a bad mood. I'm very rarely, when I'm watching hoops, I'm a pleasant guy. You know, I'm talking nonstop.
No, you're more of a fan this year. Admit it.
No, I'm always a fan.
You are.
Oh, you're more of a fan of, but I mean, I'm always a fan of basketball. I mean, the idea of watching the Wolves, I enjoy this team definitely more this year than I have in most other years. But what I'm saying is that if you have a situation where you get to see a bunch of players play, I don't care if they win 16 games. It's a worthwhile, endeavor.
It was messy. It was messy. And I think, again, I think part of this all is part of a good thing, which is that these games matter so much more. When was the last time that the 45th game of the season mattered for the Wolves?
Right.
Butler, 17, 18.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But then prior to that, it would have been Kevin Love.
And people forget what a pall was put on that team. I mean, I was arguing with fans. Fans hated that team. It was kind of weird.
I think they kind of love this team, man.
They like them, yeah. You'll have the cat hate, is as somebody who helped fuel the cat hate, it's kind of ironic that I'm saying enough is enough. But, I think enough is enough.
I think what they like is a lot of the other surrounding pieces, too, with Cat being the tent pole, right? And around it, it is a more fun team. It kind of, I didn't find everything that transpired last night as egregious as even you, but certainly as a lot of the fans, but even as you, I don't always, you know, like that, right? Where,
right.
Fuck you, Dane, you know? it's all different. For me, I mean, my first year, and it was very much on a part-time basis covering this team, was that 17-18 team. So for me, it has been so much where the games don't matter past the second half of the season.
Right.
So it's a new experience, and it's much more intriguing.
Will they screw it up in the next 2 weeks? That's the question, right?
That is the question. I don't know the answer to that. I hope not. I mean, it makes doing my job a lot more fun when they're in it. And I mean, they're not going to fall. They're not going to fall out of it.
Can you imagine? I mean, what it would take to finish 11th in the West right now?
Don't even go. Don't end it. Don't end it.
They would have to be like 2-8 for the next, you know, 30 games. They would have to be like 6-30.
Finch said it's go time, so it's go time. You know, let's see what happens. Next game, Brooklyn on Sunday night. I'll see you at that game, and then I will talk to all of you listening to this after that. Until then, he's Britt. Read his column over at Min Post. I'm Dane at Dane More NBA. Talk to you soon. Peace out. How I'm feeling, man, I hope it never stop, yeah. Green and hot so you can find me in the crowd, yeah. Don't let standards ever bring you down, yeah. Hope you dancing like nobody else around, yeah.